Welcome to Election Connection with me, your host, Ruth Newman, on all-volunteer community radio, WFMP 106.5 FM. Today's show is all about the intersection of fair housing with environmental justice, and it comes to you from the Louisville League of Women Voters Democracy in Action Forum, this one held April the 15th. The next voice that you hear is Sandy Renner of the Louisville League.
I want to thank you for coming. I want to remind you our next Democracy in Action is May 20th, a Monday, but it is going to be at the main library, and it is going to be about youth violence in Louisville, the realities, interventions, and some solutions. We also are busy with primary season. We have a variety of election forums going on. And House 41 is April 24th at the Bonnier Library at 6:30. I just wanted to also let you know that during this past 12 months, we have registered over 1,300 voters. If you want, we can always use volunteers for that. Tony Curtis is going to serve as our moderator. Tony is the executive director of the Metropolitan Housing Coalition. He was named executive director in January 2022 after serving as director of development communications. Tony's mission is really to lead the coalition to advocate and educate across the community to eliminate barriers to housing. And those of you who are involved in these issues, you know there are so many barriers for people to enter the housing market. It seems like it's getting harder and harder. So I'm going to let Tony take over and introduce the rest of the panel.
Thank you very much. Yes, I'm Tony Curtis, the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Housing Coalition. We do research-based advocacy for fair, accessible, and affordable housing. You all probably know the State of Metropolitan Housing Report that we've done for 20 years as of last year. We've been doing a lot of work in this area over the years, and especially recently in regards to climate change. That was the topic of the 2023 State of Metropolitan Housing Report. You know, the housing crisis, both of these crises are connected and are the focus of our report. Both continue to be the focus of our work. Both will be the focus of our annual meeting in June when we bring Dana Borland in, who's written a book called Great Green Communities. But Kentucky has seen tornadoes in the west, flooding in the east, the Commonwealth. So we have seen temporary and permanent displacement occurring in both instances. We only often think of the climate crisis as an international and a national phenomenon, but we know from these recent events that the climate crisis is just as much an impact at the state and local levels. Many in this room are engaged in that work. And that report last year really grew out of the fact that extreme climate events are affecting Louisville more and more each year. And we really needed to drill down and really take a magnifying glass and look at this issue to see what happens. You see a lot of times displacement when it occurs in rural Kentucky, that people come to larger cities. We're in a housing crisis. We don't have enough housing units to house our citizens of Louisville. So now when that occurs, we're creating even more stress on the system. When a major climate event, tornadoes, bad shear winds, create devastation in our community, where do people go in our community? Where can they go to in our community? And so MSC has been involved in this work, looking at the intersection of housing and the environment, housing and utilities, housing and renewable energy transition, housing and the climate crisis, or our work at the Public Service Commission, intervening on behalf of low-income and fixed-income families. We've expanded that work over the last few years to also water affordability, right? You can't have a safe, stable living environment without affordable, equitable access to water, to energy, both gas and electric. So we have with us today, we have Ebony Cochran. She's leader of the Rubbertown Emergency Action, REACT. We have Richard Price. He's the director of the Louisville Metro Government Department of Codes and Regulations. Then Dr. Brian Gwynn. He's assistant professor at the University of Louisville School of Public Health and Information Sciences. And then Sumaita Rao, the director of the Louisville Metro Government Office of Sustainability. So we're going to have some expansive discussions on really how housing and climate change intersect, and each of these individuals has a particular area that they've been focusing on. And so I want to just open it up for kind of some opening remarks here for each of the panelists to talk about where has your focus been? What are you working on and why is it important? Do you want to go first, Ebony?
This is Ebony Cochran, civic activist with REACT.
So the question was, what is REACT focused on? And to be quite honest, we're focused on a lot of things. So maybe that means we're a bit unfocused. But one of the things that we've really been talking about a lot that we are not hearing a lot of people talking about is emergency preparedness. And the fact that when we talk about climate change, when we talk about greenhouse gases, we talk about it on a macro level. And so we never talk about the people who are living in the houses who are waiting for the policymakers to get the courage to make the right decisions. While the policymakers are going back and forth, we have people living in homes that are vulnerable to many things as it relates to climate change. And so one of the things that we've been doing is what we call the In the Meantime campaign, and we're doing direct support to families by providing them with a go bag, some initial items that they may need to evacuate with. And so just as an example, in my home, we have three zones. My teenage son is responsible for zone one, which includes our emergency backpacks. Each one of us in our household has one. It has radio in it. It has a life straw in it. It has things for fire, like we're going out into the woods or something. If we have to evacuate, he takes the bags first. If he's able to come back in the home, he gets our extra supplies. My husband has another zone, and then I have the third zone. So it's not just because we live in close proximity to chemical facilities and they could explode and we could all need to get out of there. But even when there's been a tornado, my son knew exactly. He got all the bags, ushered all the grandchildren into the basement, got our solar generator, and we were down there. And we knew that we'd at least have a couple of pair of outfits and some other provisions in case the top of our house blew off. And so we believe that emergency preparedness is something that's not talked about. We believe that this city, the state, and at the federal level, that money should be pouring into communities, especially those that are near or at the fence line of chemical facilities, commonly referred to as Rubber Town, and other sorts of industries.
Next is Richard Price of Metro Louisville's Office of Code Enforcement.
Codes and regulations, first and foremost, we believe that every citizen deserves to live in a clean, safe, healthy environment. And we're focused on several things to make it happen in regards to property maintenance. And when I say property maintenance, I'm talking about mostly renters, tenants that's living in conditions that is really unlivable. What's tough for me and what I've seen is that, you know, people, the tenant tend to be afraid to report these type things. So we got to come up with ways to get into people's houses to see these violations and hold landlords and property owners accountable. So we're working on several things. We are strategically trying to work in a way that would engage the public to work with us, and when they see us coming, that we are here to help and not to harm. We got the renter registry that we will be publicly announcing pretty soon, in another week or so, that is up and running. This requires renters, the property owners that have long-term rentals, to register their properties. And not only register properties, give us access to come in twice a year to do random inspections. That put the tenant in a good spot where they don't feel like they gotta throw their landlord under the bus. We can come in and actually do random inspections. We're also working on vacant and abandoned properties, which is a huge issue in this city, to make them safe. Because if the property is abandoned and it's vacant and there's a structure there, then there is the situation where we have squatters and people come in and then there could be a fire. So it become a public health issue. So we go out and we board these properties and try to secure them while we work the process And we maintain them. We actually keep them clean and boarded up until we can get to the point where we can secure them, and then hopefully we can build some low-income housing and provide housing, as we're talking about. We don't have enough housing for people to live in. Or we can maybe sell the property to maybe a contractor or someone that could come in and do that. So our guys really work hard in doing that. Another piece is, and we issue permits for all buildings. We are required by the state of Kentucky to make sure that all buildings, commercial and residential, are built to code. And again, it goes back to safety, it goes back to public health, that these buildings are built in a way that is safe and that is sustainable. And that's why I'm so excited to be partnering with for our meeting coming up. One of the things we're working on that I feel that Code Red has not been focused on, given intentional, dedicated focus on, and that's sustainability, which is so important. So we're working on that also. So we're just so excited about the work that we're doing, and I just hope that I can really engage the community in a way that we can be successful doing.
Next is Dr. Brian Gwynn, U of L Assistant Professor of Public Health and Information Sciences.
Thanks for having me, Tony. It's always a pleasure to talk about what I'm passionate about. But unfortunately, what I have is bad news. I don't have a good elevator speech for you to feel warm and fuzzy. That's because we're in the midst of a perhaps century-long epidemic of childhood lead poisoning. Every year, hundreds of kids are found with an elevated blood lead level in Jefferson County. I think we're averaging 300 to 400 kids a year. It's really more than that. That's really driven by testing and funds for testing. So if we had universal testing and universal reporting, I think that number would be higher than it is. The sources of lead in the environment that I've found is it's lead in the topsoil. You all are old enough to remember lead in gasoline. And tetraethyl lead was a great thing. It produced a lot of horsepower in our automobiles and our airplanes, but it exhausted tetraethyl lead right into our environment. And that elemental lead is still in the soil. And so if you live in a densely populated area that's been around for 100 years, you're gonna have hazardous amounts of lead in the topsoil. Topsoil is a primary constituent of house dust. So if you have kids, you don't need lead paint, you just need house dust. The other main source of lead in the environment is paint. I go to abandoned properties, land bank properties, every Friday and test for lead. Every home I go to has lead paint. Every single one. The only ones that don't have lead paint have been wrapped in vinyl siding. But aside from that, there's lead paint everywhere, primarily in homes built before 1950. In West Louisville, we have neighborhoods where essentially every home was built before 1950. I mean, the lion's share of pre-1950 housing goes from the Highlands to West Louisville. So you get into like Portland, Raglan, those areas, there's just so many homes built before 1950. Because of this, we know that since 2005, 10,000 kids have been found with an elevated blood lead level in Jefferson County. And, you know, why do we care? I'm a professor. I feel like asking questions. Why do we care? Who knows the answer?
Because they're in formative years, and it becomes part of the development of the brain.
That's exactly right. So lead mimics calcium in the body. All of our organ systems essentially use calcium. Anywhere calcium can go, lead can go. Lead can cross the blood-brain barrier. Lead can get into the brain, can get into the neurons, the neuronal mitochondria, can disrupt the calcium kinetics. It literally kills brain cells. Research done up in Cincinnati by Dr. Kim Dietrich, 30 or 40 year prospective cohort studies found children exposed to environmental lead early in life have smaller brains and adulthood. Not just smaller brains, less neurons in the brains and a smaller frontal lobe, a smaller prefrontal cortex. This last part of your brain that really doesn't develop until your mid-20s. This is part of the brain that gives rise to your executive functions, right? Your intelligence, your empathetic concern, your moral reasoning, things that we would all want to preserve for ourselves, but certainly protect for our future. So there's lots of reasons we should care about this issue. Not just that, lead causes kidney disease, it causes hypertension, it causes heart disease. There's lots of things lead does to our health, and when you look at disparities in health in Louisville, they're happening where we're finding lead. So this is a tremendous issue. We know that kids that live from Portland to, let's say Butler High School, if you're familiar with Louisville, and then from Shawnee to Smoketown, there's a big circle there. Kids that live in that circle have a 9-fold increased risk for lead poisoning. That's not 9%, that we're talking 900%, a tremendous increase in the risk for childhood lead poisoning. So this is a tremendous problem that we're dealing with, but Metro Council just, 2 years ago, last year, Cassie Chambers Armstrong, our former council person who's now a state senator, led the charge for the ordinance. That goes into effect later this year, I think?
25.
So registered rental properties will have to, if they're built before 1978 or 1950, they'll have to undergo a lead risk inspection. If lead is found, they'll have to remediate or abate those hazards before the property can be rented. Sounds great. We're hoping it works out. This is a natural experiment. Years from now, we'll look at the incidence of lead poisoning, see what happens. Okay, that's the first part of the bad news. Second part of the bad news. I have a pet project going on with March of Dimes and Family Health Centers and our health department, and we are testing pregnant people at their first pregnancy visit. And what we found is after 400 plus tests, somewhere between 10 and 15% have a clinically meaningful blood lead level while pregnant. So we pretend that 12 and 24 months is when we lead test. We pretend when that's when kids are exposed. Kids are exposed in utero. So all of those damages to the brain and crossing the blood-brain barrier and the calcium kinetics, that's happening in utero. So if mom or the pregnant person has a blood level of 2, ACOG views that as an adult issue. It's not a big deal. It's less than 3.5. Who cares? To the child developing, that's a huge issue. Also, presumably, mom's not licking the floorboards. Mom's not engaging in type of behaviors. Mom's not putting her hands in her mouth. They're probably washing their hands before they eat. So if you have a 30-year-old person with a blood level of 2.4, presumably they're living in a leaded environment. That means when baby comes and baby's crawling around, this is a tremendous risk for the child. So what we're hoping to do with this project is ask for NIH money this summer or the fall and really investigate this. And really, don't tell anybody, we want to go after ACOG and have their policies align with CLIP, which is if you live in a high-risk zip code, it's universal screening. And so let's stop thinking of elevated blood lead levels in pregnancy as an adult issue and think about it as a pediatric issue. And let's align how we're thinking about hazards to health.
Next is Sumedha Rao from the Mayor's Office of Sustainability.
Thank you again for having my office here. So we are the Office of Sustainability at Global Metro Government, and our mission is to create a climate responsible and climate resilient global, and to prioritize those that have disproportionately been impacted by these issues historically. So when we talk about climate responsibility, that means thinking long term about how climate change is going to impact us and what our responsibility is, especially as you know, a city that holds a lot of responsibility for that historic legacy fossil fuel pollution. How can we do our part to contribute to reducing those emissions? And the climate resilience is what Ebony was talking about, right? Because while we're dealing with mitigation, what do we do in the meantime to help people and prepare for the impacts that we're currently facing that we will inevitably face in the near future? So on the mitigation side, we've done a lot of plans and studies over the year. One of them is our greenhouse gas inventory that talks about where all of our major emissions are coming from. And we found through that 2016 inventory that the largest slice of our emissions lie in residential buildings. And this is, you know, in the average city, you might find that transportation is the largest slice of their emissions pie, but because we have a very fossil fuel intensive energy grid, and we have pretty old building code that's state mandated. At the local level, we can't really exceed state level building code, and we're on the 2009 energy code right now. That just means we have a lot of really leaky homes that are not just wasting a lot of energy and burning a lot of fossil fuels, but also directly impacting how much people spend on energy bills. So we've also looked at data on energy burden, which is kind of like, you know, the percentage of your income that you spend on your energy bills. You know, in the housing world, the standard is if you spend over a third of your income, typically that's how they classify housing affordability. And with energy burden, it's 6%. So if you're spending more than 6% of your income on energy bills, then you're considered an energy burdened household. And we find that, you know, the energy burden maps in our city pretty much mirror you know, what you would see from any other kind of structural inequality. You will find that, you know, the parts of the city that have seen historic disinvestment, that have seen redlining practices, that have seen other kinds of environmental justice issues, also face really high energy burden. So when we're talking about mitigating, we are trying to prioritize those residents that are facing that issue the most. Nationally, there's data that says that unaffordable utilities are one of the leading causes of evictions. So we know that there's a direct relationship with, you know, having that disposable income, being able to use that to stay in your home and then be able to spend that money on other things. So a lot of what our office has been doing is creating plans, public input, creating programs, going after federal grants to try to fund some of this work. We also have programs that make it a little bit more accessible for people to make these investments. So for example, we have a cool roof incentive program that offers a $1 per square foot incentive if you install a more energy efficient roof. And half of those funds are dedicated to our high heat areas, which are kind of west and south Louisville, where you will see higher urban heat island effect. We have a solarized Louisville program, which offers discount to solar panels and connects residents with a vetted installer. And we've had about 150 people participate in that program to date over the last couple of years. And as part of that, again, we have a small grant program through which we have been able to put free of cost solar panels on about 15 homes. When you hear about the testimony of those participants, you know, even the ones that save $30 or $40 a month, it just means a lot to them because that's something that they can invest in their water bill, for example, which they were having a hard time paying, or on food or something else. So it may seem small, but it matters. Energy preparedness side, Ebony's right, we have a lot of work to do there. We've created a climate resilience and adaptation plan called Prepare Louisville that included a lot of community input that talked about some of the vulnerabilities that Louisville specifically has and what we can do, or what the specific threats that Louisville has and what community wants to do to protect ourselves against that. When we apply for funding, we do try to include some of those programs. For example, there was a large grant that we went after recently, which, if funded, will help us create these resilience hubs that are solar powered with backup batteries, so people have a place to go with reliable power in case of outages and other such issues. I guess that's the gist of it. When we do tend to be focused on energy, but we know we hear increasingly from the community about every sector. You know, climate change is a crisis exacerbator, so it's like a risk multiplier, so every issue is even further heightened by it. So we're feeling that, you know, the pressure being pulled in a lot of different directions because we're seeing these risks show up in multiple different sectors. You know, for example, we've seen that when there was some kind of natural disaster, I think it was in Asia a few years ago, it had a ripple effect on the supply chain of chips and things like that. So any global catastrophe anywhere can spike up prices for people here. So there's local issues, but there's also global forces that are going to impact especially the most vulnerable people first. So it's kind of a balance of thinking long-term, thinking short-term, thinking in immediate term, balancing what we do right now with what we do in the future and trying to prioritize these different areas.
As you can see, like, doing this work is not just one organization. It's all of us are in constant contact on a various scale as far as issues, funding opportunities. Samantha and her small team have been hard at it, trying to bring some money into the city to combat these issues. But you can see smart people doing really important and engaging work here. But going back to Ebony and thinking about kind of that proximity to potential environmental disaster, she said the fence line, right? Who is living near the fence line? Who are the households that are most impacted? What is some of that history here in Louisville?
I say people living in West and Southwest Louisville, predominantly African-American areas and low-income areas. I just have to say this, that we talk a lot about greenhouse gases, and that is super important, but I think we're going to have to muster up the strength to talk about a number of things simultaneously. What I've seen happen over the years is that we've increased our talk about greenhouse gases and decreased our talk about chemicals. And so the people that you're talking about who are living in West and Southwest Louisville mostly, even in the Parkland neighborhood, last week I was at a meeting with residents who live near a small family-run wood place, and they are talking about how that wood dust is coming out, coating their cars, eating the paint off their cars, how there's fires in the stacks at least 4 times a year, just tons of things happening there. And then you have the cluster of chemical facilities, Rubber Town, which put out chemicals that attack every one of our body systems. And so we have chemicals that are mutagens. I mean, doesn't that sound crazy? Sounds like X-Men or something. But the real thing is that there's a class of chemicals called mutagens, and they are coming into our neighborhoods. And you know what mutagens do? They mutate genes. We have toluene. We're talking about lead and how lead is so horrible for learning and all sorts of other things. So is toluene. It's even associated with behavioral problems, developmental problems, reproductive problems. All of these chemicals are mixed up and coming in our into our neighborhoods. So I think that it's going to be important that we start speaking simultaneously about greenhouse gases and chemicals. Let's not X out the chemicals, because that's happening to us today. You guys have heard about the sewer odors that have been going on. You know, every time I ask the Air Pollution Control District, how do you differentiate between the sewer odors and chemical odors coming from Rubber Town? They can never give me a good answer on that. They always just blame MSD and say that it's the sewer. But it's not just the sewer. It's not just the hydrogen sulfide. It's all of these chemicals. And we have to make sure that we have policy that's strong enough, but not just policy that's strong enough. We have to make sure that the people in the positions at the city are doing what they're supposed to be doing and protecting us in our communities. I mean, it's just so many things out here. We talk about the intersection between climate and housing. When you think about what's happening in Florida, where whole insurance companies are just leaving the market, and then us here, we're scared to file a claim if there's a bad storm because we may lose our homeowners insurance. And so things like that, we need to make sure that there's policy in place where these insurance companies can't just drop us when we've been paying the thousands of dollars every year, especially if you live in neighborhoods like mine that have been redlined historically and currently. I'm paying a lot more insurance than my friend who lives right outside of Lake Forest in Middletown. And it's absolutely ridiculous. And I live in a neighborhood where I've been there for 24 years. We've not had a break-in, we've not had any cars stolen, tree-lined street, nice neighbors, walkable, all of that, but yet my insurance is super high and always at risk of being dropped.
Richard and X, he was talking a lot about building trust, right? You talked a little bit about kind of a vision and like how you do that. Like, I want to dig down there, I guess, a little bit more. I mean, there's this fear, right, of a loss of a roof over an individual's head. When we're talking, we need 50,000 units at or below 50% area median income in our city. The fear of actually talking to somebody and creating a relationship with your landlord that might end up kicking you out of that house and you have to find something else is real. It's very real. So thinking about something like the rental registry is very important. You know, I guess I want to get down to like how you build that trust, and then how is this enforceable? How is the rental registry enforceable in our city?
You know, how do you build trust? Well, you know, first and foremost, the stakeholders, your main stakeholders, which are the citizens, they must know who we are and what we do. And I think that in the past, because we have been, as an agency, reactive instead of proactive. Okay, so, you know, citizens inherently tend to don't trust the government. And it's because a lot of times they don't understand what we do, and the little portion that they do understand, we don't do it, you know. So how do you deal with that? You gotta be clear about your vision and who you are and what you do. And then you gotta do what you say that you are. If I say that we're code enforcement, we property maintenance, we do inspections, and we manage the rental registry, we gotta do that. And we got to do that in a way that puts people in a position to feel good about what just happened, okay? And the way you do that, again, you got to show up, you got to identify what the problem is, and you got to put that tenant or the other landowner. You know, one thing I'm telling my staff, I want to put all stakeholders in the position to be successful in whatever they trying to accomplish. Okay, so the landlord wants to make money. Okay, that's fine. We want you to do that. But you got to do it in a way that is safe and healthy for the people that is providing you that money. So we got to get people talking to us. That's my goal. If I'm going to build trust with the main stakeholders, I got to get people talking to me. So I got to be in the community. I got to get people to ask questions and to be educated about the rental registry. You ask the question, how is that enforceable? Well, it's the main way to enforce that is getting tenants to talk to us. Now, under the ordinance right now, and personally, I feel like the ordinance does not go far enough. And it's something that I plan to address with Metro Council in the future, because right now we only have a third that we are required to inspect, and it's more of a random pull. You know, we can pull a third and we can go inspect. I think we need to go further than that, okay? We need to use our resources and the power that the ordinance gives us to, hey, if the landlord doesn't fix it, we will fix it and send them the bill. Send the message that we're serious about people living in a safe and healthy environment. So that's the way you build trust. And it's 100% enforceable, but we got to be very resilient to the pushback that initially we would receive from landowners and some tenants, because we got tenants right now that won't let us in. We hear the complaint, but they are literally shaking in their boots because they're so afraid that they're going to be targeted by their landowner. Here's the reality. It's clear to me. Slumlords causes homelessness. Absolutely it does. And when we allow, you know, these slumlords to operate and not held accountable and force people out and put people on the street and then cannot get that property filled, then the property becomes vacant and abandoned. And then people, you know, find themselves home. So yes, we can enforce it. I think we can do a little more, and we gotta build trust. And the way we do that, we gotta educate, and then we need people talking back to us.
Thank you very much, Richard.
If you just tuned in, this is Election Connection on WFMP 106.5 FM, and we are listening to a panel discussion on fair housing and environmental justice at the Louisville League of Women Voters Democracy in Action Forum held April 15th. Here is moderator Tony Curtis of Metro Housing Coalition.
I'm going to go to Brian next, but thinking about, you know, 300 to 400 kids a year that we know of with limited testing. Lead exposure really starts prior to that and carries on after that. Can you talk a little bit about the barriers to expanded testing? To, you know, this is a preventable thing. It's a knowable thing that lead exists and it impacts kids particularly in this way. Can you talk a little bit about the barriers?
Next is Dr. Brian Gwynn, U of L Assistant Professor of Public Health and Information Sciences.
LMPHW had a nurse that would go out and do lead testing. We lost her, and that was a tremendous loss to the city for lead testing. And then in 2012, the federal government kind of defunded lead testing in the United States. In Louisville, that resulted in 57% reduction in lead testing. And that lasted for several years. So in 2011 and 12, we had 6,700 kids tested. In 2013, we had 3,000 kids. In 2014, we had 2,000 kids. 2020, we had 2,000 kids. That doesn't correlate to the population. So it's coming, we need federal funding, promote testing, and then possibly policies that ask for universal testing, not just kids that are in high-risk zip codes. Listen, my daughter had her first communion on Sunday, went to a party afterwards. The parents are surgeons. They live in a $1 million home over in Cherokee Gardens. They had just bought the home, and the prior homeowner had gone to all of these auctions and bought different things, and she bought a banister for her stairwell. I walk in, and I didn't know. It was covered in lead paint, and they have four kids. They got a 6-month-old to a fourth grader. everything in between. And I just could not believe these physicians would have lead paint there. That's just an anecdote, but it's everywhere. So they don't live in a high-risk zip code, so their kids might not get tested. Their parents are doctors, and their pediatrician might just assume that they would know to test them. So we need some understanding that mice properties can have lead in them. I can go 50 meters in any direction and find you lead paint, guaranteed. So these might not be considered high-risk zip codes. Pediatricians might not consider this something that's an issue for them. But I'll make this my last point about this. There are pediatricians that think that if they test one sibling, they don't need to test both, or that if they get one blood lead test at 12 months and it's normal, that they don't need to retest. And the blood lead data set we have is very firm. We've had kids that have had blood lead level of, you know, 3 when they're 2 years old, and then 3 years later, another sibling, a younger sibling, has a double-digit blood lead test, and then they go and retest all the kids. 12-year-olds they're testing, and they're finding the kids have blood levels like 30 and 40 micrograms per deciliter. This is really, really high blood lead levels. And we see this kids that have double-digit blood lead levels for years, 3, 4, and 5 years at a time. This is a tremendous issue. So I would like to have all pediatricians engage in universal testing, and then we just need more federal dollars coming in and actual employees at LMPHW dedicated for testing.
What happens when all of this money is coming to Lowell, because it obviously is? What happens when there is conflict in distributing those funds? How do we equitably think about getting that in the hands of organizations, of people, governmental entities that make the most sense and have the most impact, right? I'm intrigued to kind of hear, how do we do that? What happens when the money starts to flow?
That's a really great question, and I do hope we have the problem of millions and millions of dollars and how do we flow that money really well to our community. But I think one of the challenges we're facing, and I guess it's a good problem to have, but the Inflation Reduction Act has made billions of dollars available for sustainability, and a lot of it, they're hearing cities, especially, you know, blue cities and red states that know that we're not going to get a lot of state support, they're directly granting it to cities, which is very helpful to have that direct federal support. But we're hearing that the federal agencies are not sure what's going to happen in the next election, so they're trying to get all this money spent this year. And the result of that is that they drop $500 million grants and give you a month to apply for it. So, you know, we are doing our best. We don't go after these massive grants every day. So we do as much community engagement as possible. We do surveys. We get ad hoc groups together. We invite everybody on a Zoom call. We have like 100 people on a Zoom call trying to figure this out together. We try to do our best to take as much input as possible on the front end during the planning process, but we recognize that it's not perfect. It's just impossible to have a thorough process with that kind of timeline. But what we are doing is building into these grant applications processes for equitable, you know, community engagement, accountability, and transparency. We're proposing to put together these community advisory boards and to work with the city's equity and procurement task force to make sure that the way that these programs are designed and distributed does have as much transparency and environmental justice and community oversight built into it as possible. Our goal is not to make everyone happy, because that's not going to be possible, but to at least make sure that everybody has access to the data, to the reasons why certain decisions were made, to have the ability to participate in decision making.
So for me, the money is, you know, grant dollars for research, and what I want to do is understand why pregnant people in Louisville are at risk for lead exposure. I'm assuming it's coming from the environment, but, you know, I want to do a study in the coming years where we work with the community, work with stakeholders, and really understand the sources of lead for people that are pregnant. Are they nesting and disturbing their environment and doing remodeling? Is that releasing lead into the environment and exposing them? What's really going on here? With the hopes of, let's start universal screening during pregnancy. If we have a clinically meaningful lead level during pregnancy, let's treat that like it's a child that's exposed, and let's start the remediation efforts now. Let's also stop pretending that a blood level of 15 is the magical threshold for some sort of mandatory action. I think it needs to be a lot lower than that. There's this underlying ethos of libertarianism in the United States where, you know, if I represent a government, let's say, people might not want to listen to me or believe me, and I think that's a real issue. But there's, I'm telling you, thousands upon thousands of homes in Louisville with lead paint in them and lead hazards around them. And until we make an investment to really get the lead out, we're gonna have this epidemic go on for another 100 years. Unacceptable, so.
One of the things that I think is a well-kept secret, that there is money for property owners, that we have a property alleviation program, that if you have external violations of property issues, that there is some money through our housing program that you can get. And that's external. I would love to have grant money where we can actually give to landlords and property owners to fix things internally. Truly, it's about the money. In a perfect world for me, as the head code official for Louisville Metro Government, is for our guys to come out, see that violation, notify you, give you a moment to fix it. If you don't fix it, then we fix it ourselves and send you the bill that alleviates that issue for that person that's living in that environment.
Next is Ebony Cochran, civic activist with REACT.
I think equity begins with those in impacted communities helping to create the plan. This isn't happening. What typically happens is the plan is created, and then people come in and say, hey, we're having a stakeholders meeting about this great plan, and basically they want people who are in the impacted neighborhoods to rubber stamp the plan that's already been put together. And so REACT is part of a coalition called Kentucky Just Transition Coalition. We're a group of organizations that have gotten together, looked at this IRA funding, and started from the ground up by canvassing hundreds of homes, inviting people who live in impacted neighborhoods to tell us how they believe climate change is and will affect their households. And so together with residents, we're building a proposal of how these funds need to be used. And so my suggestion would be that the city tap into the Kentucky Just Transition Coalition to see what impacted communities are saying that they need. Now, with regard to what Richard talked about, I got really excited when you said that you wish you had money to fix things internally. It's one of the things that we've talked about a lot with residents. That's what they want too. I was talking to a woman who rents. She said that every time it rains really bad, the basement floods, the landlord will not fix it. She said that she has to go through and dry out the basement. So policy change, but also that could go to help with waterproofing and all that. My household, we have spent close to $20,000 waterproofing our basement, getting marine backup batteries. It is so important for people to understand that direct support is important. In 2007, we had a flood in our basement. We did not have the money to hire a company to come and get all of that wet stuff out. But we had to take out all the moldy drywall and put ourselves in danger, put our child in danger, because we could not afford to clean up the mess. So as these grant funds come in, to make it equitable, there needs to be direct support. Don't come to these impacted communities talking about, we'll loan you the money. If we had the money, we would have just gone ahead and done it. We don't have the money to pay it back. A lot of us don't. So what we want, if you want to say that they're equitable, that means you're gonna give direct grants to people in the impacted communities.
We're going to go to audience questions now for Brian. How do you know lead is in paint or the soil, and what is the cost?
Lead naturally occurs in the soil. All soil has lead in it. 15 to 40 milligrams per kilogram is kind of the background rate of lead. Anything greater than 400 milligrams per kilogram, kids should not play on that soil. There's entire neighborhoods where we're measuring it in the thousands, especially next to homes where lead paint falls into the soil. When you test it, the test, depending on where you send it, can range from $11 to $60. There's a lab in Oklahoma that will test it for $11 or $12, but you got to ship it there, and you got to use special EPA-certified testing equipment, which is a barrier for entry into the space. For soil, for paint, if it's white paint and it has like an alligator skin look to it, and the home was built before 1978, I assume that that's lead paint. We have Lockup Lead in Louisville. It's run by John Cullen. He has a tester It's essentially 100% sensitive, so it's not EPA certified because it's overly sensitive to lead. You mix water in this little bottle and you spray it, and if it turns purple or pink, there's lead in the paint. But if it has that alligator skin and it's white, assume that it's lead paint.
But then what do?
You can cover it up with latex paint. Yeah, so latex paint, you can cover it up. That's probably the easiest thing to do. What you don't want to do is palm sand it away. Because I know people that have done that. That just releases lead right into the environment. So cover it up or hire someone to remove it and replace it. There's a home off Kentucky Avenue I went to. It was three stories. Every story was covered in lead paint. The whole house. The neighbor next door, the kids' bikes were leaning against it. I mean, it was just lead was everywhere. This is where we need the money going directly to the property owners. Because, like, I couldn't afford that. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of dollars to fix that.
What about the soil? What's to be done about that?
So there have been studies done down in New Orleans, and they found that after Hurricane Katrina came in, it deposited soil over top leaded soils, and they've come back years later, and that soil is still safe. So the prevailing theory now is, if you have very dangerous amounts of lead in the soil, you can buy a product from John Collin, which locks up the lead in the soil, so if you ingest it, it's not bioavailable. And or you can just cover it up with several inches of topsoil. It's a huge issue. Most of the lead in the soil is next to the home and next to the street. Then as you get into the middle of the yard, there's less lead.
The next question is for Richard. Do you have enough code inspectors and code enforcement issues? How are you going to protect tenants who speak out?
This is Richard Price of Code Enforcement.
For the record, it is a crime to retaliate against a tenant that reports a property maintenance issue. So it is a crime. I think the best way to protect tenants is random inspections. So I think what I want to do is look back at some of our past inspections, repeat violators, and find a way to just randomly show up. You know, I will be partnering with Louisville Metro Council. I'm working with the county attorneys now to help me draw up a draft with some ordinance to change. We gotta be able to do random inspections. But the best way that I think that we can protect them is create a place where they can provide an anonymous call to us. A lot of our inspections now are planned. And, you know, the landlord knows we're coming, the tenant knows we're coming. I think the best way to really cover them is to show up and know that codes and regulations is subject to show up anytime.
Do you have enough enforcers to be able to do that?
I think we do. Still about 10 short, even now with the 58 that we have. Yes. For 2023, I asked my data guy, I want to see how many properties there was repeat violations, more than three in 2023. The number was 2,700.
Jesus.
They had more than three property violations. That's a problem.
What is the fine for that?
They started at $250 and didn't go up. But the problem is not necessarily fine, because I've also found that there are times when we issued the civil citation and they paid, but they didn't correct the problem. Cities like Detroit, New Orleans, San Antonio, you know, there's laws, there's ordinances that if you have so many violations, that the city can take your property. I think we need to get there. I think we need to be innovative in our thinking. We got to figure out a way to get the message to the property owners that this is unacceptable.
Is asbestos a problem in buildings, homes in Louisville, and what is the city doing to keep PFAS, forever chemicals, out of water?
On the PFAS issue, that is a really big issue that has incredible health impacts on people. The EPA just released a new rule to start regulating PFAS, which is very exciting. Louisville Water is currently compliant with the new regulation. So that's good news, and they do have some education and information available that they're trying to get out about the way that they do testing and how they're compliant and some of the additional steps that they're trying to take. But outside of that, I would love to hear more ideas. We do try to partner with groups that like Beyond Plastics that do education and awareness around reducing our dependence on plastics. But if there's anything else that you think we can do on a local level to reduce PFAS exposure, I would love to hear about that.
Next is Richard Price of Metro Louisville's Office of Code Enforcement.
So in regards to asbestos, a lot of what we do is based on complaints. A lot of, you know, tenants and even homeowners do not recognize. Our inspectors are trained to identify. I think we don't see it a lot because people is not educated enough to know it's there. But our inspectors are trained to go look for it and deal with it.
This question is for Ebony. Have we been successful at all in reducing smokestacks pollution in West Louisville?
I'm going to say yes, just because in my parents' generation, they always talked about when they were growing up, whatever was in the air was eating the paint off of their cars. Yeah. So in my neighborhood, I'm the third generation of living in the home I'm in. Our paint seems to be pretty good. So, but what I will say is that the pollution is so bad that any sort of reductions that we can say are a win are still not enough. One of the things my father always taught me was it's always important to know what question to ask. Mm-hmm. And one time I was in a meeting with an American synthetic rubber, was giving a presentation. They said, we have reduced our 1,3-butadiene by 99.7%. And I thought to myself, why am I in this meeting if they've reduced it by 99.7%? And so then I raised my hand and I asked, so what does the other 0.3% represent? Like, how many pounds? And he said, oh, about 100,000 pounds. And I'm like, okay, this is why I'm in here, because one chemical, you're still emitting 100,000 pounds of it, and it's only one out of a multitude of chemicals. And so when we were fighting for the adoption of the STAR program, the threat of the STAR program actually caused American Synthetic Rubber to install something that did reduce their emissions by a significant amount. But we really don't know a lot of what's happening right now. We lost the funding for that air monitoring that was happening then. So it's like you have a little bit of a win and then chemical industry pushes back. The Air Pollution Control District, they allow permits. So the chemical facility will be like, yes, we like a construction permit for this or that. And the Air Pollution Control District knows that issuing this permit will increase our exposure to chemicals, but they will permit it anyway. And so one time I asked them, I said, in all these years, how many permits have you all denied? And the guy that had worked there for a long, long time said, I've never known us to deny a permit. I feel like it's complicity.
This next question is for Richard. What can code enforcement do to fix buildings like Dosker Manor and prevent such horrible living conditions in the future?
We do inspections. So what can we do? We can cite them. And here's what I am doing. I've met with the new Louisville Housing Authority, and we have talked about not only Dosker Manor, but just the wider scope of living conditions. And we have a plan to collaborate, and we are making commitments to work together to make sure that that situation gets better and that it doesn't happen again. I think the ordinance is clear of what we should be doing, and if I had to live that moment, my inspectors get there, they see that, they issue the notice of violation, and then we hire an independent contractor to go fix it. And then we send the bill to the feds.
What can we do? What should we get involved with? So what steps league members, the league itself, take to get governments to take action? This is specifically on cleaning up lead, but I think in each of your areas there are calls to action. What are your calls to action? And I'll start with Samina.
Sure, thank you. I know that this group is very interested in advocacy and legislative priorities. So one of the biggest things that we can do is to advocate for state building code upgrade. I think it's unacceptable that we don't really have a process to review and update that code on a regular basis. We are on a very old code and it's hurting a lot of people that have to pay those bills and deal with those impacts. So update building code to the latest standards, which would not only take care of the energy efficiency side of things, but would also probably weed out things like lead and asbestos and all kinds of other challenges and just create greener, healthier buildings. And of course, there's a lot on the energy generation side. The burning of fossil fuels has significant health impacts. And I would refer everyone to the Kentucky Conservation Committee. Many of you are probably familiar with them. but they keep an eye on all of the legislative bills that are out there, and there have been some really bad ones. They do a great job of summarizing some of the bills. There is a very dangerous bill that has passed, that Senate Bill 349, that essentially makes Kentucky a coal sanctuary state. The Public Service Commission has historically prioritized the least cost energy generation. Now that renewables are cheaper than coal, the industry doesn't like that. So now they're proposing to create a whole other, like a duplicate public service commission that can protect coal industry and prevent these retirements of old and inefficient plants. So it's very damaging, and it's going to hurt ratepayers ultimately. And it's really important for us to make our voices heard.
Next is Dr. Brian Gwynn, U of L Assistant Professor of Public Health and Information Sciences.
If you have grandchildren or children that are at risk for lead exposure, which is basically everybody in the county, demand they get tested. If your children are pregnant, demand that they get tested while they're pregnant. If you're a physician, test your patients for lead. If you're a homeowner, test your property for lead. If you can afford to fix the issue, fix the issue. It's probably not going to help you, but it might help a little child in the future, and I think that's an honorable thing to do. It's the little things, I think, and vermiculite is in your insulation. Your home is sufficiently old. There's probably asbestos in the insulation. If you have 9 by 9 inch tiles, the assumption is that's asbestos tiles until proven otherwise. Atherton High School, by the way, is covered in those tiles.
Lots of schools are.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my friend's mom just died of mesothelioma. She was a school teacher for 40 years.
So every year you signed a statement that said, I know there is asbestos in this building.
Is that right?
Yes.
Gosh.
Wow.
Next is Richard Price of Metro Louisville's Office of Code Enforcement.
My call to action is what we're doing here today. Residents talking to us and be willing to tell us about these property violations and giving us an opportunity to educate is our website at Louisville.ky.gov. I've made our website user-friendly where you can go and understand you don't have to live in these conditions. These are violations and we need to know about it.
Next is Ebony Neal Cochran, civic activist with REACT.
I believe that this city needs to fight to retain local control of its air toxics. The state has been trying to take it forever. Some people in this city do not want air toxics regulated locally, but that's the best thing. It makes sure that people who are impacted by environmental injustice are in close proximity to the people who are making the decisions. We don't have to travel to Frankfurt and caravan and do all of that stuff. We can ride the bus downtown if we need to. And the people who are regulating our air locally, they know our neighborhoods. Nobody in the legislature knows our neighborhoods. Secondly, and I think most importantly, is that we need to listen to people who are impacted the most. The discussions you have with people that are impacted the most is where the solutions will come from. There may be procedures and regulations on paper, but the people in impacted neighborhoods know whether or not the regulatory agencies are actually following the procedures. We know what we're experiencing, and we are experts that need to be tapped into.
Thank each of our panelists.
That was Tony Curtis of the Louisville Metro Housing Coalition, also moderator of this panel discussion on fair housing and environmental justice, which was held on April the 15th at the Louisville League of Women Voters. On the panel were Ebony Neal Cochran, civic activist for REACT, Richard Price, Metro Louisville's Office of Code Enforcement, Dr. Brian Gwynn, U of L Assistant Professor of Public Health and Information Sciences, and Sumedha Rao from the Mayor's Office of Sustainability. And this is Ruth Newman, host of Election Connection. Thank you for listening.